And I think the first thing to say is that two of the special interest groups in particular have been very active over the last 4 or 5 months. UK Plant Sciences Federation had their AGM here yesterday, and some of you were involved in that. There was currently 29 member organisations who are part of that special interest group. And there's been a lot of work going on with Mimi, who's the executive officer who looks after that special interest group in the science policy team, to try and pull together a state of the nation on UK plant science, which is planned to be launched at the end of January. We hope that that will be a far-reaching report which will have a lot of impact and will raise a lot of debate about the value and importance of plant science in the UK. So if you're not involved and would like to be, then Mimi or Laura will sit in the back. We'd be very happy to talk to you further about that. But the end of January is when the report's coming out. The other thing to mention, I think, is the Animal Sciences Group, who on the other side of the coin have been doing an equally large amount of work, only this time particularly around the transmission of the directive on the use of animals in research, amongst other things, but that has been the primary focus. And since the beginning of the year, we've taken up the joint secretariat role for the UK Biosciences Coalition, which has involved, I think, a huge amount of work for Daniela, who works on it, and Laura and some of the other members of the team. There's been a lot to do. There was a meeting with the Home Office only last week, on Friday. Some of you will have seen that we have a new minister for the portfolio at the Home Office, Norman Baker, Liberal Democrat, you may be aware that he's probably one of the few MPs, of only a handful, who's been actively vocal about being an anti-vivisectionist and opposed to the use of animals in research, which was quite a large surprise when he was given the portfolio for the use of animals. He is saying what the department has said in the past to date, but clearly that's something that we want to watch very closely. So a lot of work going on the animal side. On the policy front, again, a number of you have been involved in the member organisation meetings that we've organised around open access. Critically important area, as you'll know, and we'll continue to do more work on that. Most recently, we look at the international comparisons, and we'll continue to monitor that space very carefully. There's a new, relatively new, Research Dissemination Committee newsletter which comes out electronically. So if you want to keep up to speed with what's happening on those societies and open access, then do sign up to that. You can do that online, or if you just want, you can just drop us an email and we'll sign you up to it. And that, I think, reminds me that there are probably now about a dozen or so electronic newsletters which you can sign up to, covering different aspects of the biosciences or particular applications. And we have something now around drug discovery development, for example, research dissemination, we mentioned, BioNet for school kids, and so on. So there's quite a lot of material out there which I point you towards if you want to follow that. On the sort of general policy agenda, research funding is always there, of course, in the background, and REF and all the associated activity, and we can talk about that more if you want. It's certainly the focus of some of the discussion today. But probably one of the biggest areas of activity, I think, for us has been the A-level GCSE national curriculum, particularly the A-level agenda recently. And we do most of that work through SCORE, as you know, in partnership again. And we have a number of you involved in working groups to feed into that. It's been a really, I think, difficult process. I noticed Julia Buckingham's here as the chair of SCORE. So you can ask Julia about it later. It's, I think, been very challenging because we have done all the right things in inverted commas. We've responded to all the consultations, been involved in active dialogue with ministers and officials and so on. But actually, it hasn't really gone the way it should have done. And A-level sciences are being introduced for first teaching a year ahead, 2015, of mathematics, for example, and ahead of the GCSEs, which feed into the A-levels. So it's not an ideal scenario, and we look forward to working with you all to try and make sure that's better. And I think we all have to think quite carefully about whether we become a bit more vocal publicly about some of those issues. For society more generally, the council have decided that there ought to be a lot of a higher focus on regional engagement, regional local engagement. We're introducing a new programme of grants for any individual member of the society to put on regional events, which I know some of your organisations do anyway. And if we can do that in partnership by sort of mashing up our funding and activities, that would be even better for all of us. So do think about trying to get involved in that. We've appointed a full-time regional coordinator for the society, David, I think sitting outside at the moment. And we'll be doing increasingly more and more activity at local and regional level. So again, anything we can do collectively would be welcome. We've recently won a grant from the Welsh Assembly Government to roll out Go for Science in Wales, and that's a partnership between primary schools and secondary schools. And I think that's particularly important because it's a great example of the way collaboration can work. Go for Science is a project which was developed by the Biochemical Society. Their agenda has evolved and changed a bit. They've handed that over to us. We've worked with them to go out and get some support for that. And it's being now rolled out by the Society of Biology, still, of course, working with the Biochemical Society and others. So, again, if there are projects like that where we can help, we'd be very happy, you know, to do so. I think perhaps the final two things to say are that accreditation of bioscience degrees continues to be a major area of activity, and I know a lot of you are involved in that. So we couldn't have gone down the route of assessing and looking at those individual degree programmes in different disciplines without your help. So we are very grateful for that. We want to carry on working with you on it. We are looking very carefully about whether or not we can introduce an accreditation programme for 3-year, 4-year in Scotland, traditional degree programmes in inverted commas. Again, we'd like to involve you in that. There'll be workshops looking at how we can roll that out, and we'll have to look at how the funding model for that will work, and we'll be talking to a number of people about what might be possible. And the final thing to say, I think, is that just in October this year, we had our second Biology Week. Quite a lot of you were involved in that, and we're planning it again for next year, and the same sort of time, the sort of second week of October. We'd really very much like to make sure we have more member organisations putting on individual events. There were some this year, but I think there could have been a lot more. And we'd again like to make sure we work with you to try and develop those. And now's the time to start doing that. So if you could get in contact with Rebecca Nesbitt here at the Society, she'd be very happy to talk to you about trying to help you put on those events and a plan ahead. So that's all I really wanted to say. Obviously, I have to try and answer your questions if you want to. We've got a great agenda to move on to anyway, so over to you, John.
Well, as Mark has said, we're very pleased to see a good turnout this afternoon from member organisations. We chose the topic, which is always a popular topic of research funding, but we're going to look at three different aspects of research funding. We'll have Sir John Arbuthnot here, President of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. He's going to talk about some of the issues that will come up if Scotland became independent with regard to research funding. And he'll be the good cop, and I may be the bad cop. But I'll introduce John in a moment. The second topic that we're going to cover is funding of PhD studentships, and we're very pleased to have David Caster, who's head of schools and careers from BBSRC, to talk about this. The BBSRC are the largest providers of the funding for research studentships in the life sciences sector, so it'll be interesting to hear what David has to say. And then thirdly, we're expecting Ian Boyd, the Chief Science Advisor for DEFRA. Ian unfortunately can't be here at the beginning of the meeting, he's going to a Russian taxi. He should be here at the scheduled speaking time of 4:00. And as some of you will be aware, the research spend of DEFRA has fallen away, and he's trying to turn this around, at least by making alliances with other organisations. And I think he'll tell us about this, because this is an area where I'm afraid previous chief scientists in DEFRA, I can say this before he arrives, were not as successful in defending the research budget, but I think he's a real hero of the research budget there. It'll be interesting to see how he's getting along. So those are the three topics. So I'm going to introduce now Sir John Arbuthnot, the President of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Sir John is a very distinguished microbiologist, about being on SGM Council, among other things. He was also, many of you won't know this, a prime mover in establishing the Society of Biology. He was one of the small group of people behind the scenes who pushed the Biosciences Federation and the Old Institute of Biology together and play a very important role in that respect. So, John, welcome, and we're very keen to hear what you're going to tell us about the impact of Scottish independence and research funding. Thank you, John.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm very pleased to be visiting the Society of Biology and speaking to you this afternoon. And as John has said, I quite well remember the early days before the Society was formed, when we were at an interim stage of bringing societies together, quite complicated politics, quite complicated relationships and traditions that had to be looked at very thoroughly. We went from the Bioscience Federation to extensive talks with the Institute of Biology, and we've now reached where we are. And just the news items that were read out today are an indication of the extent to which that's now fully integrated, which is really, really encouraging. I remember the days when I used to come to SGM meetings mostly to talk about microbial toxins and infectious diseases, but then I got diverted into other things. Although I spent 40 years doing that, it was absolutely great fun. And the other things, I thought I'd bring you up to date with some of them because it may be of interest to you. I became principal at the University of Strathclyde, where I spent 10 years from really the decade of 1990 to 2000. And almost immediately after that, Scotland began to become devolved, and we have a new devolved parliament. And for one reason or another, I was landed with the task of deciding how the health budget was going to be created and spent in that new parliament. And in fact, the report that I wrote, which was called Fair Shares for All, was the first report that ever went to the newly devolved Scottish Parliament. And it was quite controversial, because I was proposing that we should be allocating this money on the basis of need, the basis of deprivation, and on the basis of remoteness. Neither of these things had been taken into account in previous versions of the allocation system. So that was quite a battle in a way, but very interesting. I was also at that time the head of the Carnegie Trust for the Universities of Scotland, which plays quite an important role in the allocation of grants and studentships to Scotland. And then I became chairman of NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, which is the biggest individual health board in Scotland, and that was from 2002 onwards for 5 years. And that was a very, very hot time in medical politics, because there was a realisation that the way in which hospitals were distributed and run, especially in a big area like ours, was not sustainable. And you can guess how the public reacted to that, because certain hospitals had to go and certain new hospitals were built. And in fact, the last of that sequence is now being built as the biggest new hospital in the whole of the UK. And I'm very proud of that. So that was a fairly active and hectic process. I was then novelled because with the creation of the devolved Scottish Parliament, it became clear that we had MSPs in the Scottish Parliament, and there would be a surfeit of representation if we maintained the same number of MPs in the Westminster Parliament. So that had to be dealt with, and so did the voting system in Scotland for subsequent rounds of the Scottish parliamentary elections, the new Scottish parliamentary elections. And that whole thing raised the issue of who represented who in constituencies. What was the relationship between constituencies? What sort of voting system are we going to have? And so I wrote that report, which was actually implemented. And more recently, with the onset of the financial crisis, it became clear that we weren't in Scotland, indeed anywhere, going to be able to run things in the same way as we used to do. And we were all going to have to make great changes in the efficiency with which we ran public services, including health, social services, and all the council services, as well as our national services. And that was a task of coming up with a series of initiatives that would actually bring across some of these almost uncrossable barriers between health services and social services, great competition, distrust and so on. And that's working its way through now. And I'm finally playing a role in ensuring that we get integration of health and social care that is going to be fit for a population which is ageing, and similar things are happening down in this part of the world. So these are the kinds of things that I've been doing. And at the end of that, I was elected as president of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. A word about the Royal Society, it was formed 270 years ago by King George III. And he actually gave us a very, very simple remit. He wanted to see the application of knowledge for useful purposes. And because of that, society has always had a very broad church. It includes scientists, medical people, lawyers, business people, civil servants, the whole span of activities at a high learned level are represented by the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and it's fully independent of government, and that's very, very, very important. And we have 1,600 fellows. We're just about to elect our next round of fellows. So the Royal Society of Edinburgh plays a role which is monitoring what is happening in Scotland, obviously at a level which is of interest to the universities, to the academic community, but we are more and more concerned about what's happening in education of young people, what's happening in relation to opportunities for jobs, what's happening, how efficient is Scotland in transferring its expertise from the laboratory into business and enterprise. And so we have a very broad range of activities now as well. And so it almost coincided with my election, when it became clear that the Scottish National Party had won the electoral right to have a referendum on the future of Scotland, then I thought about this and concluded that this was going to be, one way or another, this was going to be 2.5 years or 3 years of the most important series of events in Scottish history for a very long time. And therefore, what role would the Royal Society play? Bearing in mind that we're a charitable organisation, we cannot take political positions, we didn't want to take political position, but I was, as president, really concerned that we might allow the drift of what happens in the press and in the media to really never really deal with the key issues on a substantive basis and listen to both sides in a non-political basis. So we decided we would have a series of constitutional debates, and we're now coming to the end of that. We've had 9 or 10 of these now, and we've got 12 to run. And these have dealt with all of the main issues, defence, the European Union, currency, taxation, science and education. All of these issues have been dealt with in debates which have been published by the Royal Society of Edinburgh and are on our website. And the plan is that these will all be completed by April. And by the end of April, we will have published a consolidated volume that is a kind of archive of what has been debated at the Royal Society of Edinburgh, what the main issues were, but also picking up other reports which will be referred to in this and collected within this archive, so that as people look back 20, 30, 100 years from now, at least they can see that somebody somewhere actually did do a very systematic job on the assessment of this very important issue. So we have been listening very carefully and talking with both governments. As president of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, I have good relations with the Scottish ministers, particularly the Minister of Education, Michael Russell, but also with UK ministers, particularly with David Willetts. So in all major discussions of what has happened in research, what is happening in research, because we have to remember, this is a process where eventually the vote will take place in September of next year. In the meantime, we have to make sure that everything is working, and we have to make sure that everything is working after that as well. So transition comes into this, and it's very important that ministers have, if you like, an impartial organisation like ourselves with which they can sound out their ideas and take advice, which we do offer them. So, the other thing I should mention in passing is that we're increasingly playing an international role. We are particularly active at the moment in EU relationships and EU funding and how that's going to affect funding across Europe. And we're also particularly involved in relationships with China, where I have visited recently and will be going again soon to take a Scottish delegation, not like the Prime Minister's delegation. This will be a delegation of high-performing academic researchers with very high-performing business people and some policy people, because the Chinese are very keen to get discussions between researchers and policymakers, and that we will do. And we have really formed very good relationships with the Chinese academies across a wide range of activities, not just in science. If we come now to the issue of research, one of our debates which we held in the University of Aberdeen was about the issue of universities and research. I think at the very beginning on this issue, which is of core importance to the scientists in Scotland, and I think also of core importance to the scientists across the UK, we have to realise that we feel strongly about it. I mean, it's a terribly important subject, a really absolutely key subject. But the electorate does not consider this to be a key subject. In fact, yesterday, Alex Salmond is doing a good job of presenting his white paper widely across Scotland. And yesterday he took the whole cabinet to a very big meeting in Edinburgh, where three or four people could ask any question they wanted. And how many questions were there about higher education and research? One. And who asked the question? The chief executive of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. So there is no build-up of huge interest. We have to remember that in discussing this issue. I've been following and in fact discussing with both governments their positions on this. I think it is the intention of the Minister for Education in Scotland to actually produce a specific paper on the funding of research. It has been promised for some time and has not come out. And we're constantly asking Mike Russell when that is going to happen. He says tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And it hasn't happened. But what has happened with the UK government is that the BIS has produced a Scottish analysis paper specifically on research, and it's been very thoroughly researched, and a number of people in this room, I think, John, were at the meetings that took place during last summer with David Willetts, who systematically drew out what is really happening in relation to collaboration between researchers across the UK. How is the funding distributed? What are the proportions? There's actually now quite an argument developing in Scotland about what Scotland's share of research monies actually is. And it varies, the estimates have varied, and I'm not going to get into that now. But in the most prolifically successful areas of medical science and bioscience, it's as high as 20%. The overall average, there's an argument about it, and it's a bit of a political football, and I'm not going to get into it. But Scotland has done very well. And I think one of the things we have to bear in mind is that science across the whole of the UK at present is assessed on a very thorough assessment of quality. Quality is the name of the game in our science community. It's not the name of the game necessarily. I mean, I worked for many years in Ireland. It was a much less clear situation. Political preference was very much involved. That doesn't happen here. What we have is the allocation of research funds on the basis of competitive bidding and competitive assessment, impartial assessment, and that works extremely well. The research councils operate that principle as well, and they are very thorough in that regard. So you don't just get money by asking for it, it has to be very high quality science. And across the whole of the UK, we can safely say that we do really hit the high spots in relation to our position in the league tables. As a unified country, we are very effective. So the question is, if Scotland became independent, how would that work in the future? What are the things that we would have to look at to see whether it was working properly and what might happen? Well, the Scottish Government, although I've said it hasn't produced a detailed paper, has in its immensely thick white paper. I've never seen white paper. You can hardly carry it. It's like a big brick that comes through the letterbox. It doesn't fit through the letterbox. Anyway, if you read this very carefully on page 426, you will find reference to research. And all it says is that we have a very good integrated system at present in the UK, and the Scottish Government, if it became independent, would attempt to maintain a similar system. If you actually get down into the detail of how that might work, we're talking now not about a United Kingdom of countries that are united by various legal and constitutional measures. You're talking about two separate countries, Scotland and the rest of the UK. And the record of this kind of integrated approach to the distribution of funding, not just in research but in other things, is not very good between countries. And it's not a particular feature of the UK, but it could be a difficulty. And if you probe the Research Council, they do see really quite significant difficulties ahead of conducting a process where you have different ministers in different countries with slightly different agendas, and not necessarily slightly different agendas, because in Scotland we're beginning to hear that perhaps we should do rather more Scottish research. Now, when you think about how that compares with the system we have at the moment, I think you have to conclude that this is not going to be as smooth a process as people might like to think. So we need to have much more information about how that's going to be done. And that is one of the reasons why I have been pressing, and the Royal Society of Edinburgh in general has been pressing ministers to be very clear about that. You can't argue with the fact that the UK government has done it. They produced a very, very thorough paper, and I recommend that to you. And the final point I want to make about research is that it's not simply a case of very good groups in Glasgow or Edinburgh and Aberdeen and Manchester and London and Oxford and Cambridge competing and being well funded. These groups are themselves interactive and collaborative, because the subject matter that they're studying is actually catalytic between these centres. So you get a rapid movement of postdocs, of research leaders from one place to another, and the fact that the money goes to, say, Dundee and not necessarily to Cambridge for that particular project doesn't matter. There is an exchange. So it's not simply putting money in a location where there's great expertise. It's actually in building linkages at a scientific level which are complementary in terms of the disciplines and the specialties. And if you create uncertainty in that process — uncertainty is always a destabilising thing — then are we still going to get that? Are we still going to attract the highest quality postdoctoral researchers from other countries? I mean, I recently introduced a very bright young engineer who's doing fantastic work in space in Scotland. He has a group of 30, two of whom come from the UK. So this is a very international dynamic process. I'm going to leave it there, just leave you with these questions hanging in the air, and perhaps John will take them up. Thanks very much.
John, thank you very much indeed. Since I'm a retired academic, I can be a bit more explicit about some of the details. John has to be a little bit circumspect. He's explained very carefully to you the kind of
role that the Royal Society of Edinburgh is attempting to play. But if I just put one or two numbers, and some of these come from calculations that we've made within the Society of Biology, Penny made some of these calculations. I mean, the UK research spend is around about £4 billion. And if you calculate on the basis of the population of Scotland, which is about 8.5% of the UK population, then Scotland should hope to get something like £369 million. 2 years ago, which is the last year for which we have complete and good data, we got £571 million. So that's £202 million greater than, and I'll use Mrs. Thatcher's old expression, that the juste retour. And in Scotland, I think the Scottish universities would argue that that is because they're pretty good. I mean, in international league tables, there are five Scottish universities in the top 200, three in the top 100. And they do perform well, but they depend utterly on being part of this integrated infrastructure. And putting my BBSRC council hat on, the BBSRC has a number of institutes, one in Wales, one in Scotland, and the rest in England. But let's take the one in Scotland, the Roslin Institute. That plays a fundamental role in delivering a lot of UK animal science. And without the Roslin, the UK animal science program couldn't be delivered. Equally, there are other institutes in England which contribute significantly to what the Scots need in their agriculture, in their fisheries, and things of this sort. So with the benefits of a medium-sized country, I think we can't call the UK a large country, but a medium-sized country that actually is pretty good and effective in spending its science budget. And John referred to this. I mean, I think the classic description is to call this the Haldane principle. Haldane was the civil servant who devised the scheme, which basically said it's the scientists who will decide, not the politicians. And let me give you, I mean, I can tell one or two slightly wicked anecdotes, because John has organised a lot of meetings, and one of them was on science and funding. And one of the speakers at that meeting, who is an anti-unionist, shall we say, is an engineer who thinks that because he happens to work on tidal energy, he would be better funded in Scotland because that would be a local priority. Well, but I can tell you he's not being funded because he ain't good enough. And the EPSRC don't like his research.
I couldn't comment on that.
No, you can't comment. That's what I said, we'd be a good cop and a bad cop. And I could take other examples of that kind of thing. I've just had a week in Ireland reviewing, I won't mention the institution, really one of the larger Irish universities. And one of the headaches that they have, they've established some research institutes in areas over the last 10 years that used to be funded well by the Irish government, but the Irish government has decided that it's only going to fund in 14 designated areas going forward. And unfortunately for this institution, those areas do not map nicely onto where they've invested their money. So there's a potential disaster there. And that's the sort of thing that those of us in Scotland are really quite nervous about. So I put a strong view, I mean, but John put the proper overview, and we're keen to encourage some questions and discussion. We'll share answers with John. So.
John, I'm not sure it would be your sir, John. What wasn't touched on was the issue of science that's not related to research council funding as such in institutions like the Royal Botanic Gardens, James Hutton Institute,
okay,
and so on. And I wondered how you thought these might be affected. I think they get money centrally through the Scottish part of the budget at the moment,
yeah,
don't they?
They do. There is an allocation of money that's given by the equivalent of DEFRA in Scotland.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And these, they used to be called SAB, Scottish Agricultural and Biological Research Institutes. And they are reasonably generously funded, but I have to say that colleagues of mine, for example, in the James Hutton, are concerned that some of the topics that they wish to work on, they're being actively discouraged from working on. I can be slightly indiscreet here. One of the areas that they're very good at is sort of manipulating plants by genetic engineering techniques. And the SNP don't like that. They're basically anti-GM. And of course, the biggest plant disease problem in Scotland is Phytophthora.
and the Scottish farming community put on vast tonnages of fungicides. I mean you know probably the numbers even better than I do, but you're talking in some bad years of 15 applications of fungicide, so you can harvest your potatoes to make chips or crisps or whatever you're going to make. There are resistant varieties that have been developed now. Most of them involve a bit of genetic engineering, because it's been necessary to introduce genes from distant relatives of the potato that happen to be rather good. I mean, the nightshade species in particular are a good source of resistance gene. And that will need to be done. I mean, you know, because this is now, I'm a keen gardener. I've lost all my potatoes 2 years out of the last three. I mean, when the rot comes, it wipes the crop out within a matter of a few days. If you,
I mean, the main expert on Phytophthora retired about 2 years ago and has not been replaced.
No,
in Scotland,
no.
For example.
Fair criticism.
Could I just say that this is a very important question, because I think if Scotland did become independent, the government, the presently government-funded laboratories, would become Scottish government.
Oh, yes, that's right. So I was wondering.
And therefore, the priority of science, as John has said, would shift to the priority set by the Scottish government. But these institutions also interact in an integrated way with our best research laboratories.
Oh, yes, yes,
in,
yes,
in,
yes,
for instance,
agree.
The Rosslyn,
yes,
is a key element of that.
Yes, it's a key. It's a key element with the Pirbright Institute in terms of delivering animal research. Some of the virus programs in the Rosslyn, some of it is in the Pirbright.
I just wanted to ask what you thought about the EU issue in terms of European-funded researchers in Scotland and any potential issues if there's a delay in ascension with continuity of funding and just that kind of area, what you thought the likelihood of that was.
Debates about what might happen to Scotland in relation to the EU are pretty high up in the agenda of things that are important in these debates about independence. We did have a very good meeting, and I would recommend people to ask us if they want to see these papers, because they do raise all the questions. There are different views about it. I mean, I think my view, having listened to a lot of this, is that Scotland would eventually become a member of the EU. But
it's the eventually that's the word.
It's the eventually.
Yeah.
Because the EU is a master of delaying the bureaucracy and following the process to the minutest level. I'm not sure how long it would take Scotland to get through that process.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, a lot of this is to do with this lag time. How, you know, we have at the moment we've got pretty well continuity. We obviously have to wait from one budget to another in both countries, but we know roughly what's going to happen. We have strategic plans. But when you're in an uncertain situation in relation to what's happening in the EU, then, you know, you're in a serious position. Scotland also has to then, as a separate country, develop a whole new diplomatic corps.
Yes.
So we have to then establish diplomatic relations with all these countries, or most of them, and we have to argue our case, as happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I happened to be in Ireland when, in the earlier days of the EU, when Ireland played a very, very cunning game with the EU and got huge flexibility on how they could use their budgets. In fact, the Irish upsurge in biotechnology arose from a slice of money which I was involved with, which was supposed to go to particle physics. There was no particle physics in Ireland.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to joke about that, because Peter Higgs hadn't gone to Ireland. So there was none. So we said, well, can we use this money to do something else? Oh, sure, sure.
Yes.
And we established the Biotechnology Fund.
Yes, but
on the basis that the universities each had a role, and the role was specific and defined, and you had to do that. Incoming companies would actually go to the particular area of the plan where they would get support. That worked very nicely. These days of that kind of game in the EU are over now. So it's more difficult.
The other practical point is our research councils, the UK research councils, operate a very effective lobbying mechanism. in Brussels. They have officials permanently located there. And actually, although I wouldn't shout this at a European meeting, the UK does as well in relative terms of getting Euro funding as Scotland does in terms of getting UK funding, if you like to put it like that. I mean it's, and that would be lost to Scotland, because I can say with some feeling, I got a very large grant from the EU to rebuild Glasgow University's field station, or part of it, but it took 6 years from the moment that we first put pen to paper till we had the cheque. And it was because it needed so many counter signatures and making sure that we weren't breaking any regulations. So EU money is problematic in that respect.
So we have a chance for more questions in the later discussion.
Yes, should think we should move.
Yes,
we should.
Is that okay? Yeah. So there will be a chance. And just to say, I should have said that we recorded Sir John's talk, and that will be passed on to everyone that attended. So thank you.
Okay. So it's my pleasure now to introduce David McAllister from BBSRC. He is the person in BBSRC who's in charge of the funding for studentships and postdoctoral fellowships and all the sort of training programs